So we are looking into Romans 6 tonight. We're not going to make it through the whole chapter, Romans 6, because I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about immersion, since that's a topic here in Romans 6. And I also think it's kind of a seasonal topic as we come into the season of tshuva, the season of repentance, the 40 days that come before Yom Kippur. So you may or may not be aware of this, but 40 days before the Day of Atonement, it begins on Rosh Chodesh Elul, the beginning of the month of Elul. We begin a period of time where we are concentrating on repairing relationships and issuing apologies and rectifying our misdeeds and improving ourselves and repenting. I mean, in a word, it's repentance. See, this period of time, it should, today is the 22nd of Av, so it should be about 7 days out. I think we would be next Monday night, we might be looking at Rosh Chodesh Elul. So during these 40 days that would start next Monday, if I'm correct on that, either next Monday or Tuesday or something. Yeah, go ahead, take a look. Rosh Chodesh Elul. I'm not looking for the first of Elul, I'm looking for Rosh Chodesh Elul, which you would think is the same thing, but it isn't always the same thing.
There we for go. Elul.
Okay, so, yeah, next Monday night. That's right, next Monday night is Rosh Chodesh Elul, okay? And if I'm reading this calendar correctly even. In any case, you get the idea. It's coming up. And this period of time corresponds to the story of Moses going back up on the mountain, for the second time back up on the mountain, for the after the sin of the golden calf, he goes up to try to make atonement, to try to restore the relationship. And so in commemoration of those 40 days of waiting for Moses to return with the new covenant, the new tablets of the Torah, every year the Jewish community practices this 40 days of repentance. So I always think that this is corresponds to our Master's 40 days in the wilderness as well. That it makes sense to me that his immersion would have been on Rosh Chodesh Elul, because then he goes and is tempted in the wilderness for 40 days, ends up with a showdown with the devil, which is exactly what happens during the 40 days, and at the end of the 40 days is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Oh, I can't prove that. I just think it's, if I'm reading the Gospels Jewishly, so to speak, I recognize those themes in the story of the Master's temptation, right? So we're coming up on the 40 days, and because of that, because of the association with the temptation of the Master, and which was initiated with his immersion, that's why I said it's a seasonal theme to talk about immersion. Romans chapter 6, speaking about immersion. So, before we start in our text tonight, I want to talk a little bit about baptism. You know, you could say that baptism is a contentious issue in Christianity, or it has been at least historically a contentious issue. Why is that? Why has baptism been a contentious issue? I think some of you, as I'm looking around the room, are from Lutheran backgrounds. Some of you are from Catholic backgrounds. Some of you are from Baptist backgrounds. So we have people in the room from different perspectives on the idea of baptism, significance, and what baptism is all about. When I was a kid, that was sort of a big deal. You know, baptism was like, we really, because in my church tradition, we were baptized as, you know, in our teen years usually. And so we really felt like people who were baptized as infants weren't really baptized at all, you know. And not only was it the wrong age to do it, but it was like they weren't even baptized. They were sprinkled with water. It's like, what's going on here? Anyway, so
10 years old is a way better age.
Yeah, 10 years old. You've got such a grasp on everything. Yeah. right.
And the thief on the cross was pulled down off.
Yeah, I could have been. I don't know. No, I don't think so. So it's been that's all to say that it's been a contentious issue. But what I like to preface any baptism teaching that I do, I like to preface it with saying it doesn't really matter what your background is in baptism or what your experience or what it is that you know, because when we study Jewish roots, when we study Messianic Judaism and the Messianic Jewish form of baptism, all of those arguments are irrelevant because we're studying a form of baptism that we all had in common once. Now, you see, that's the thing that Messianic Judaism offers. We can cut past all of the, well, we think it should be done this way and we think it should be done that way, and it's all fine. We can do it however we want, and you can do it however you want. But what we're studying about is something that we used to all have in common. Way back in the day, back in the first century, back in the days of the apostles, this is how baptism was done. You know, so you can feel, you know, maybe somebody will say, how do you know that? Well, because Jewish people are still doing it. It hasn't changed. It's still part of Judaism. And that sometimes is a big surprise for people to realize, because you think of baptism as a Christian ritual. That baptism is something that, oh, there's handouts here at the end of the table, I'm sorry. You think of baptism as something, an institution that was introduced in the New Testament, and that Christians practice. You don't think of it as any sort of Jewish institution, but it is. It's a Jewish purification ceremony, a purification ritual. It's not called baptism in Judaism. It's called tevilah. Tevilah b'mikvah, immersion in the mikvah. But in Greek, the word for immersion is baptisma, right? And so that's how we got the name, baptism. But it was it's a very common ritual in Judaism. It's just a central part of life for. And it's in Judaism, baptism happens, or especially in the days of the temple, it happened on an almost routine basis. It was a routine sort of thing to go and get, you know, like every time you're going to the temple, every time you were, every time you were had become ritually unclean, you would probably go through a baptism, and you became ritually unclean almost every day. I mean, just by living a human life, you would come into contact with ritual impurity. So if you're a wealthy person, you might have even had your own mikvah, your own baptismal in your basement. It's the archaeology of Jerusalem demonstrates that most of the priests, the wealthy priests, did. They had their own private facilities. So it's a very common ritual, something that was going on all the time. After the destruction of the temple, ritual purity was no longer so much of an issue. So baptism kind of wasn't being practiced nearly as much, but it was still being practiced primarily for in preparation for the holidays, maybe in preparation for the Sabbath, because that's kind of like entering into the holy place. You're entering into holy time, so people would still immerse before holy days. People would immerse in preparation. There's a handout here. You got one? Okay. People would immerse in preparation for a time of fasting or spiritual focus. You know what I'm saying? People would immerse, women immerse after the Nidah period. The menstrual period was actually longer than the menstrual cycle, but women would immerse after completing the cycle. So there's all sorts of reasons that the community continued to use baptism. And then in addition to all of those, baptism was the last step in the conversion, in the, and still is. I don't know why I'm, you know, always using the past tense, but I guess because I'm thinking of the days of the apostles. But baptism is the last step in a conversion ritual. So if you're becoming Jewish, legally converting to become Jewish, as we've learned about, you know, to become a proselyte in the, I tell you what, these people out here with their motors, they never stop. It's like garage logic going on out here. You know, I had to record yesterday. It was just insane. It was like 8 solid hours of pistons and cylinders. Anyway, immersion is still part of the conversion ritual. So, if I, for example, was to go to Chabad and say, "Well, I've changed my mind and I want to become Jewish." They would probably, you know, run me through some basic Jewish education for a while. First, they'd say, "Oh, no, you don't," 3 times. That's obligatory. And then run me through some basic Jewish education. Maybe teach me a little Hebrew and that sort of thing. Make sure that I understand what I'm getting into. And after a while, go through some sort of ritual circumcision, but then the last step would be immersion. When I come out of the water, that's it. That's the transition. That's where it's you've crossed over. You've made a legal change when you come out of the water. I would be no longer a Gentile. I would be Jewish, having come out of the water. That's how it works. And for women, of course, baptism became the main focus of the conversion ritual. So, for example, it says in the Talmud, when he comes up after his immersion, he is deemed an Israelite in all respects. It's a legal change. So, and the rabbis even went so far as to say that it's absolutely a legal change, a new legal identity that's invested in you so much so that... I'm remembering this correctly. I could be wrong, but I believe there's at least one opinion in the Talmud that people who were you were forbidden to marry because of being too closely related, you were no longer considered related to them because of the legal change that had taken place. I mean, you still couldn't marry them because they weren't Jewish. Now there's another reason you couldn't marry them. But so if I'm remembering that correctly. Here's another quote from the Talmud. Rabbi Yossi said, "One who has become a proselyte is like a child newly born." This is interesting language. So another way to translate that would be one who has become a proselyte, one who has gone through the mikvah to become a proselyte, is like someone born again. And this is where the language, the born again language in the Gospel of John comes from. We have that language in the Gospel of John where the master says to Nicodemus, he says, a man must be born again. And Nicodemus says, "How can I enter again into my mother's womb when I'm already, grown?" And, everyone who teaches on that always says, "Oh, Nicodemus, so silly. He thinks that the master was speaking literally. He doesn't know that, he doesn't understand it's a metaphor, that it's figurative. Like the guy's an idiot." Instead, Nicodemus is using the same figurative, metaphoric language that Yeshua used. Yeshua said, metaphorically, a man must be born again. Nicodemus recognizes the idiom immediately as one converting to Judaism. He points out, "I'm already Jewish." But he stays within the idiom, saying, "How can I enter again into my mother's womb?" I mean, he's just saying, "I'm already Jewish. Why would I need to go through a conversion ritual?" The master's speaking of a conversion of the heart. He's speaking of a spiritual transformation that needs to take place, not a legal transformation. So that's what's going on in that conversation. So here you see the example. So this is one of my favorite quotes. I've used this quotation over and over and over in little pieces here and there in my writings for... This is from Arya Kaplan's book, Waters of Eden, which is all about the mikvah. It's all about the about mikvah and immersion and the immersion ceremony, the meaning of it, the symbolism of it, the procedure, the halakha, all of that sort of thing. It's a great book. So here's what he says. Emerging from the mikvah, you know, a mikvah is just, it's a living water, baptismal of living water is the way you could think of it. So it has to be built into the ground. It has to be, the water has to channel to it naturally. It can be rainwater, it can be spring water. Usually it's rainwater, I guess, nowadays. We don't need to talk about the laws of the mikvah. You can learn it some other time. Anyway, you get the idea. A mikvah, it's usually like a pool. I mean, a pool, you could translate it as pool. It's like a pool with steps going down into it ordinarily. You just go down into the pool and dunk yourself three times and come up out of the pool. That's all there is to it. Nothing to it. So he says, emerging from the mikvah is very much like a process of rebirth. Seen in this light, we see that the mikvah represents the womb. When an individual enters the mikvah, he is re-entering the womb, like Nicodemus said. And when he emerges, he is as if born anew, or born again, if you like. Thus, he attains a completely new status. When a person immerses in the mikvah, he is placing himself in the state of the world yet unborn, subjecting himself totally to God's creative power. So this is a little mysticism, because you're in the water. Like the Spirit of God moved over the waters. You know, you're down in the water. When a person immerses himself in water, he places himself in an environment where he cannot live. Were he to remain submerged for more than a few moments, he would die from lack of air. He is thus literally placing himself in a state of non-existence and non-life. Breath is the very essence of life, and, according to the Torah, a person who stops breathing is no longer considered among the living. Thus, when a person submerges himself in a mikvah, he momentarily enters the realm of the non-living, so that when he emerges, he is like one reborn. Because Torah law defines life as someone who's breathing, if you're breathing, even if you're artificially breathing, as long as the breathing is happening, the person is alive. This is like end-of-life issues. You know, where you have to sign the consent forms and say, you know, unplug me if I'm in that state where I'm just being artificially strict halakha. You can't do that. You cannot choose to end a life. You cannot choose to end your own life. You can only, you know, because breathing is alive. And to disconnect a breathing person then would be to commit a murder in halakha. I'm not weighing in on the ethical issue myself here. I'm just telling you what the Orthodox opinion is. Anyway, so he's using the same example he's saying, but when you're in the mikvah, it's like, you can't breathe water. You're not Aquaman. You can't breathe water. You are dead when you're in the mikvah. Thus, when a person submerges himself in a mikvah, he momentarily enters the realm of the non-living so that when he emerges, he is like one reborn. To some degree, this explains why a mikvah cannot be made in a vessel or a tub. So, you know, the Baptist church, baptismal up at the front wouldn't be a kosher mikvah. If that was a kosher mikvah, we would have had a mikvah here at Beth Emanuel a long, long time ago. If we could just put in a tub, you know, or a jacuzzi or whatever it is, you know, that would be great. I wish. But no, it has to be built directly in the ground. For in a sense, the mikvah also represents the grave. When a person immerses, he is temporarily in a state of death. And when he emerges, he is resurrected with a new status. We therefore see that immersion in the mikvah represents renewal and rebirth. All right, so that's the symbolism of baptism from a Jewish perspective. And I like this quote very much because it really gets into, it's not so much the mechanics of it, but what it represents. What does immersion in a mikveh represent? Well, it represents rebirth, a born-again experience, so to speak. It represents a legal change of identity, and it represents, so to speak, death and resurrection, right? So the Pharisees were very big on this.